From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I don't have illusions about the policies of the United States, and the United States is not looking after the welfare of the Iraqi people. The United States government is conducting a belligerent policy for its own greedy interests.
U.S. forces have detained former Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz. We will speak with Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill, who interviewed him several times, and analyst Dilip Hero. Beijing has sealed another hospital and ordered 4,000 people to stay at home. We'll look at the SARS crisis. And in Tulia, Texas, Tom Coleman has been indicted on 3 counts of perjury. He's the sheriff's deputy whose sole testimony led to the controversial drug sting that led to the arrest of 10% of the African-American population of Tulia.
He was the lieutenant county of the operation. There are much bigger fish to fry in Tulia.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Former Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz has turned himself in to U.S. forces. Aziz gave himself up in Baghdad after discussions with U.S. forces through an intermediary, this according to the Guardian of London. Intelligence experts say Aziz is unlikely to possess information about weapons of mass destruction or Saddam's current whereabouts. But the fact is that he is alive suggests that Saddam Hussein and his sons may also still be alive. The Guardian reports Aziz may possess explosive information on the extent of the West's past support for Saddam. We'll have more on that story in just a few minutes. Key oil exporting countries agreed today to cut crude oil exports by 2 million barrels per day starting in June to try to stem the fall of prices and make way for the expected resumption of Iraqi exports later this summer. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, made the decision at its Vienna meeting. Iraq did not attend the meeting for the first time since OPEC was founded in Baghdad in 1960. Its former oil minister is on the list of most wanted Iraqi officials. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal is reporting the U.S. government is setting up Iraq's oil industry to run like an American corporation, with a chief executive and management team vetted by U.S. officials who would answer to a multinational board of advisors. The advisory board will be chaired by Philip Carroll. He's the former chief executive of Shell Oil. Carroll will represent Iraq at future OPEC meetings. Fadhil Othman is expected to be named the Iraqi vice chair. He worked as an Iraqi oil executive before Saddam Hussein came to power. The interim management team will be composed of current and former Iraqi oil sector officials. Newly appointed executives will answer to the advisory board, which in turn will answer to General Jay Garner, the new U.S. ruler of Iraq. U.S. Marines have begun patrolling stretches of the Iraqi border with Iran to screen border traffic for so-called hostile infiltrators. The operation began amid concern in Washington that Iranians may be entering Iraq to stir up anti-American sentiment among fellow Iraqi Shiite. U.S. Central Command said the Marine Border Patrols will search, interview, and possibly detain all people attempting to enter and leave Iraq through Iran. Meanwhile, Reuters is reporting the U.S. may use Iran's main rebel group, the Iraq-based People's Mujahideen, to pressure Tehran as tensions rise between the two countries over post-Saddam Iraq. For years, Washington shunned the heavily armed group as a terrorist organization. The left-leaning group broke with the ruling clergy after the 1979 revolution against the U.S.-backed Shah and waged a bloody campaign in the early 1980s with a wave of assassinations of top officials. The British Defense Ministry said yesterday soldiers returning from the Gulf will be offered tests to check levels of depleted uranium in their bodies. The tests will assess whether they're in danger of suffering kidney damage and lung cancer as a result of exposure to U.S. and British munitions. The ministry was responding to a warning earlier in the day from Britain's premier scientific body, the Royal Society, that soldiers and civilians might be exposed to dangerous levels of radiation. The warning challenged earlier reassurances from the British Defense Secretary that depleted uranium is not a risk. This news from Pennsylvania. A 14-year-old boy armed with 3 handguns shot and killed his junior high school principal before fatally shooting himself in the head. James Robert Sheets was an 8th grade student at Red Lion Area Junior High School, located in a quiet community north of Baltimore. School and police officials described Sheets as a nice average kid who had no known history of trouble with the principal or anyone else. And this news about North Korea. It has admitted to the United States for the first time that it possesses nuclear weapons and threatened during talks in Beijing to test or export them. This according to a senior U.S. official in the Financial Times. The bellicose warning and North Korea's demand for bilateral meetings without the Chinese hosts led to the talks' collapse. The U.S. had long suspected North Korea had 1 or 2 nuclear bombs, and this was confirmed by Pyongyang's envoy at a dinner Wednesday night after the first of 3 scheduled talks on North Korea's nuclear program. Chinese officials sealed off a second major hospital today, and roadblocks were thrown up around Beijing to combat SARS. This after China yesterday quarantined thousands of Beijing residents who've had contact with suspected carriers of the deadly virus. All college students and teachers are prohibited from leaving the capital for the May Day holidays, but throngs of people are trying to escape at Beijing's railway stations. China announced another 5 deaths and nearly 200 new cases. All of this comes as health advocates are trying to draw attention to malaria today on Africa Malaria Day. Malaria is far more deadly than SARS. The World Health Organization and the United Nations Children's Fund are reporting that some 3,000 African children die every day of the disease. 1 million people die every year. But malaria generally strikes impoverished people in the global south, whereas SARS appears to cross both class and country lines. More on these stories later in the program. Attorney General John Ashcroft has ruled that broad categories of foreigners who arrive in the U.S. illegally can be detained indefinitely without consideration of their individual circumstances if immigration officials say their release would endanger national security. Ashcroft released the far-reaching decision yesterday in denying bond to an 18-year-old Haitian who landed in Florida with more than 200 other refugees. The Washington Post reports the ruling means that groups of asylum seekers can be locked up without hearings and without recourse to release on bond. Immigration advocates denounce the ruling. The executive director of the Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center, Cheryl Little, said, quote, "You'd think the attorney general would have better things to do these days than target an innocent Haitian asylum seeker." She also said detentions of an earlier boatload of Haitians had cost the government $12.5 million over a 6-month period. Today is the deadline for male immigrants from Egypt, Kuwait, Jordan, Indonesia, and Bangladesh to register with the U.S. government. Immigrants who report to authorities are photographed, fingerprinted, questioned, and in some cases detained and deported. During the last 5 months, nearly 130,000 male immigrants and visitors, predominantly Muslims, have been questioned in immigration offices, airports, and border crossings. A UN vote on gay rights was derailed yesterday at the last minute by an alliance of Muslim countries. The UN had been due to vote on the matter for the first time in its almost 60-year history. But 5 Muslim countries delayed the vote until today, and introduced amendments that remove all references to discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and render the resolution meaningless. UN sources told The Guardian that major U.S. allies, Pakistan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, as well as Libya and Malaysia, are doing everything they can to stop the resolution. And a South African court has sentenced anti-apartheid heroine Winnie Mandela to 5 years in jail after being convicted on dozens of counts of fraud and theft. Mandela immediately resigned from parliament and posts in the ruling African National Congress. State prosecutors said letters bearing her signature were used to secure loans for bogus employees of the ANC Women's League, which she heads. Her lawyers argued she was duped into participating in a fraud she knew nothing about. Winnie Mandela is known as the mother of the nation for her struggle against apartheid during her former husband Nelson Mandela's 27-year imprisonment. After the sentencing, she released a statement saying, quote, "The ANC is my home, its ideals are my passion, and its endeavors to make South Africa a just society is a cause that I will not relinquish." Finally, the director general of the BBC has attacked U.S. television and radio networks for their, quote, shocking and gung-ho coverage of the invasion of Iraq. Greg Dyke warned against new British government proposals that would allow U.S. media corporations to take a greater share of British television and radio. He said they could lead to a loss of impartiality in news coverage. In his first public comments since the invasion, Dyke said, quote, "The U.S. has no news operation strong enough or brave enough to stand up to the White House and Pentagon." Dyke should have said no corporate news outlet is strong enough to take a stand.
6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Ha ha.
Michael, my dear.
Come say this
about
don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. The apathetic bullshit, send them all your Prozac.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, Michael Franti, listener sponsored. I'm Amy Goodman. Former Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz has turned himself in to U.S. forces. Aziz gave himself up in Baghdad after discussions with U.S. forces through an intermediary, according to the London Guardian. Intelligence experts say Aziz is unlikely to possess information about weapons of mass destruction or Saddam's current whereabouts. But the fact that he's alive suggests Saddam Hussein and his sons may still be alive. He was the only Christian in the former Iraqi government and not a member of Saddam's hand-picked Tikrit clan. He never wielded power and was number 43 on the list of 55 most wanted Iraqis. The Guardian reports Aziz may possess explosive information on the extent of the West's past support for Saddam Hussein. He was appointed foreign minister in 1983, was largely credited with securing Western support for Iraq against Iran. Aziz became prominent in 1991 following Iraq's invasion of Kuwait when he led talks in various countries trying to avert war. We will be going to Dilip Hero in a minute, but first to Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill, who interviewed Tariq Aziz several times over the last year in Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy.
Can you give us more on his history and his significance right now?
Well, I'm wondering who is going to be leading Tariq Aziz's interrogation. Will it be his old friend Donald Rumsfeld, who he shook hands with in 1984 at a time when the U.S. was aware that Iraq was actively using chemical weapons, or his old friend Jim Baker, the former Secretary of State, who he praised. The first time that I met Tariq Aziz, my impression was that this man has the politics of a classic member of the Republican Party. He went on and on for at least 20 minutes about how fond he was of the Iraqi relationship with the Reagan administration during the 80s, and how those were times that he remembered as solid between Iraq and the United States. Tariq Aziz was the only Christian, as you said, who was in Saddam Hussein's ruling elite. I would not say that he was in the inner circle. Particularly over the last 2 years, what we saw was a real consolidation of the power of the Tikrides. We saw the rise of Naji Sabri as the Iraqi foreign minister. Tariq Aziz was primarily relegated to the role as the public face for the Western world. He wasn't the public face of the regime for the Arab world. That was much more the role of Naji Sabri, the foreign minister. Tariq Aziz was someone who would meet with foreign dignitaries when they would come to Baghdad. He would meet with solidarity groups. He was a Ba'athist ideologue, and that was the primary role that he served for Saddam Hussein's regime, was to build solidarity ties with groups around the world. Yes, I think it is true that one of the reasons why he was able to survive was because he had no true popular support base in Iraq. He was very seldom used for domestic propaganda purposes. He was known as Iraq's most famous diplomat. And, I mean, this was a man, this was one of the preeminent diplomats of the Arab world over the last two decades. He was a man who worked behind the scenes diligently at trying to secure a very close relationship with the United States throughout the 1980s. He was the public face of the regime in 1990 and 91 during the so-called Gulf War. He was the public face of the regime again in 1998 when the Clinton administration bombed Iraq for 4 days. You know, this is extraordinarily significant for propaganda purposes on the part of the United States, because he's perhaps the second most recognizable Iraqi in the world, second only to Saddam Hussein. But as far as what Tariq Aziz really knows, the only thing I think that's of concrete value to the United States is that he knows how the process works. He knows how the system works. He knows how the Ba'ath regime functioned. But I don't think this is a man who knows where Saddam Hussein is. I don't think this is a man who knows where any potential weapons of mass destruction are. This was a man who was not anywhere near the ultimate inner circle in Iraq.
Jeremy, can you set up this interview that you did with Tariq Aziz in mid-May when you talked to him about what he thought of U.S. foreign policy towards Iraq? Where did you do the interview?
This was at a time when the United States was really beginning to escalate its threats toward against Iraq. I was in Baghdad, and any time you are going to be interviewing any high Iraqi officials, there's always a degree of uncertainty to how that's going to go down. And so I only knew that it was going to be on a particular day that I would be meeting Tariq Aziz. And sure enough, it was very late at night. People from the Iraqi foreign ministry and the secret police came to the hotel. They said, you need to put on a suit and tie and be downstairs in 5 minutes. So I ran upstairs. I quickly shaved, put on a tie, which I had to borrow, actually, from someone at the hotel. And then they put me and a colleague in a Mercedes, in the back seat of a Mercedes-Benz with totally tinted windows, couldn't see out, no one could see in. And we drove around the city for a good 20 minutes before we ended up in an underground garage. And then next thing I know, I'm in an elevator with people in Ba'ath Party uniforms, and we're taken in, and Tariq Aziz comes walking out wearing house slippers and his Ba'ath Party uniform and smoking a Cuban cigar. And then he takes us into the room, sits us down in his leather chairs, and says, so what do you want to talk about?
Well, let's take a listen to what he had to say. This is Tariq Aziz, last May, interviewed by Jeremy Scahill.
This policy of the U.S. government is not a new one. It started in 1990. It continued throughout the whole decade under the first Bush administration, under the Clinton administration, and now under the George W. Bush administration. The main objective of the American belligerent policy is to impose its influence over the whole region. all the pretexts which are being used against Iraq and the leadership of Iraq are false pretexts. The issue, as it was said, is oil. The issue is to impose American imperialistic control on Iraq in order to use the resources of Iraq for the benefit, for the greedy interest of American capitalism. This is the issue. Iraq is not producing weapons of mass destruction. They are lying, you see, and using those allegations as a pretext to disinform the American public opinion about the reality of the situation and get a false support to their military threats. Well, for us as a people, when we are being threatened, we have to prepare ourselves for such a development.
There have been reports this week that the United States is increasing its attempts to organize the so-called Iraqi opposition, increasing the funding, trying to bring them together. How is Iraq going to respond to these actions by Washington with the Iraq opposition groups?
Frankly speaking, we do not care about all these activities because they are a complete failure. There isn't an opposition to our leadership that can have integrity and respectability. That's not the issue. The issue or the real concern is when the bombs are thrown at our people. America can throw bombs and missiles at any place in Iraq, and that creates death and destruction. But we are not worried about the opposition, you see. Let them do what they want. They are spending their own money, the taxpayer money, you see, on those people who are worthless and who cannot do anything serious.
It's been well documented that the United States and other foreign entities have attempted to kill the president of this country. There have been assassination attempts. Are those activities continuing today?
They say that we want to target President Saddam Hussein, we want to target the Iraqi leadership. They are doing that, but as we say, we leave it to God, you see. God is the great protector of our leadership, of our leader, of our people. And here, among our people in Iraq, we feel very safe.
Would this country be prepared to endure yet another massive bombing? Would the government be able to survive that if the Bush administration began a massive bombing of this country?
Well, we hope that there will be no massive bombing of our country. But if that takes place, we will survive. Yes, we did survive in 1991. We are a courageous people. We are in our country. We are fighting in our country. We are not fighting outside our country. So when you fight in your own home, with the help of God, with the help of all honest people in the world, yes, you will survive. And we are optimistic that we will survive.
How did the September 11th attacks, do you think, impact the current situation between Washington and Iraq?
Well, Iraq has nothing to do with those events. We saw them on television, as many people in the whole world, in the United States, saw them. We do not condone the killing of people, you see. We do not rejoice that. We have been the victims of many terroristic attacks against us by the pro-Iranian groups in the past. But the American government is using those tragic events in pushing forward towards a very belligerent militaristic policy, global-wise, you see, which is a real threat to the whole world, as it is a threat to Iraq, because they are targeting Iraq as one of their next victims in the so-called war against terror.
That was Tariq Aziz speaking to Jeremy Scahill last May. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, Dilip Hero will talk about the fact that Tariq Aziz is now in U.S. custody, having turned himself in yesterday. Stay with us.
The pledge to resist. We believe that as a people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our name.
Not in Our Name, Saul Williams here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, as we return to Jeremy Scahill's interview with Tariq Aziz last May. Again, he has turned himself in to U.S. forces in Baghdad. The reports are that he turned himself in after discussions with U.S. forces through an intermediary. Intelligence experts say Aziz is unlikely to possess information about weapons of mass destruction or weapons or Saddam's current whereabouts. This is Tariq Aziz.
Some people, especially in the U.S. and the U.K. governments, are focusing on one issue of the whole picture. The whole picture is the suffering of the Iraqi people, the sanctions which have been imposed for more than 12 years. What about lifting the sanctions? The inspectors stayed in Iraq for around 8 years. They did not report honestly to the Security Council that their mission had been done and accomplished. If they are back and back to the previous vicious circle, that's not going to solve any problem for the people of Iraq. Secondly, there is one important fact in the whole picture. The American government, with the help of the British government, attacked Iraq a number of times in 1993, 1996, and in 1998, while the inspectors were in Iraq, you see. So the question of inspection is not going to solve the military threats. It might be used, you see, as a pretext, as the inspectors themselves might be used, you see, to prepare the ground for a military attack. So
that is an excerpt of an interview with Tariq Aziz done last May. Again, he has turned himself in to U.S. forces after having discussions with an intermediary. This, according to the London Guardian. We go now to Dilip Hero, journalist, author of 24 books, including his latest, Iraq and the Eye of the Storm. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dilip Hero.
Good morning to you.
His significance, Tariq Aziz, what you think he knows now, what do you think of him surrendering?
Yes, I think he has surrendered because he has to remember that Mr. Aziz is 66 years old. Okay, so I think it's not very easy for a man of that age to move around, run around. Of course, one might as well say that Saddam Hussein is 65 years old, but Saddam Hussein has got a very strong body of bodyguards and other supporters that they can move him around and make sure that he's not too uncomfortable. But somebody like Mr. Tariq Aziz, who was never very close into the close circle, did not have that many bodyguards to move him around. So apparently he thought better to surrender, and also to say that, of course, to remember that Tariq Aziz is his not real name. His real name is Mikhail Yahuna. He is a Chaldean Catholic Christian. And, in that sense, he's not a part of the what you may call the top Sunni Muslim leadership of the Ba'ath Party, which was running the country until, of course, recently.
Dilipiro, what about his relationship with the United States over the years, his friendship or relationship with James Baker in the, leading up to the first Gulf War?
Yeah, I think it's nothing like he had anything, independent of Saddam Hussein, because nothing moved. Grass did not grow in Iraq unless Saddam Hussein said it should grow or it could grow. See, so therefore, he wasn't in any way setting up some kind of a back channel to the Americans without the knowledge of Saddam Hussein. You know, he was very loyal to Saddam Hussein. If you look at his brief biography, which is in my Dictionary of the Middle East, he joined the Ba'ath Party when he was 18 years old. You know, and that means in 1954. He was born in 1936, and he was the editor of the Ba'ath Party newspaper, Al-Thawra, which means the revolution. And, of course, you know, and at that time, Saddam Hussein was a young man. And, of course, as Saddam Hussein's star rose, he attached his loyalty to Saddam Hussein and rose with him. But whatever happened had to be sanctioned and, in fact, guided by Saddam Hussein, you know, and it had to do with hello? You know, basically what happened during Iran-Iraq War 1980 to 88. See, it is during that period that Saddam Hussein developed very strong relations with America, starting with getting intelligence reports from the National Security Agency and the CIA, and those meetings actually used to take place in Amman, under the auspices of King Jordan of Jordan, King Hussein of Jordan, and I don't think he himself would travel to Amman to talk to the CIA, etc., etc. But you see, the main thing about Tariq Aziz is that he has postgraduate degree from Baghdad University in English, and because he was fluent in English, I mean, he is fluent in English, and that was gave him the importance of a foreign minister and a deputy prime minister. He traveled a great deal. He was the intelligent, articulate face of Saddam Hussein's regime to the Western world. That did not mean he had much input in the real policy making, which was the privilege of Saddam Hussein and his very close advisors, and of course his two sons, Uday and Qusay.
The latest news we have is that a son of the former Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz negotiated his father's surrender over a satellite phone with the help of a friend in the United States. Who is his son, Dilipiro?
No, I'm afraid, I mean, I don't have any such details about it. You see, I mean, I can talk about general policies, etc., you know, who exactly did what. I mean, that is something I'm sure is left to people who are in that business. I am, you know, so I think I know Tariq Aziz's background, and also to remember, and this is something worth remembering, that his importance, at least as the deputy prime minister, and of course Saddam was the prime minister as well as president, was that he was a Christian, and that established the secular credentials of the Ba'ath Party. Also to remember that the three leaders who set up the Ba'ath Party in 1947, one of them, in fact, the ideologue, was a man called Michel Aflaq. Now, Michel Aflaq was Christian Greek Orthodox. I think that is something to bear in mind, that, you know, those people who try constantly, even now they haven't given up, to keep pinning Al-Qaeda to Iraq and Saddam Hussein, tend to forget that Al-Qaeda is a purely religious, Islamic fundamentalist organization which under no circumstances would deal with a regime where the deputy prime minister like Tariq Aziz, whose real name, I have to say again, is Mikhail Yahuna, and, you know, cooperate with him. Because according to people like bin Laden, all Christians are crusaders. So the whole idea that has been, you know, propped up in America, and which was one of the reasons to go in and attack a country like Iraq, was that Iraq had links with Al-Qaeda. And so I'm just giving you this understanding that the very basics of the regime were secular, and Tariq Aziz was the face of that particular secular Ba'athist socialism and nationalism. And so I think in that sense he was very important to the regime. But that doesn't mean, I have to repeat, that he had real input because into the policy making, because that was the privilege of very few people who were close to Saddam Hussein, who related to him. And of course, at the same time, he was very loyal He was always very loyal to Saddam Hussein, and that's why he rose to the position that he did.
Finally, the extent to which Tariq Aziz will talk about the U.S. relationship with Iraq over the years and its support of Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athist regime. Do you think the U.S. is concerned about this and will strike a deal with Tariq Aziz?
Sorry, with the U.S.? Sorry?
Is concerned about this and will strike a deal with Tariq Aziz.
Strike a deal. I think Tariq Aziz is not going to get American policy anywhere. Because, see, Tariq Aziz does not have his own constituency. Please remember that Christians are only 4% of the population of Iraq. 96% of the people in Iraq are Muslim, of which 60%, as we know, are Shiite. And of the remaining 36%, half of them are actually Kurds. 95% of Kurds are Sunni, but of course they do not put this up front because the Kurdish minority and the Arab majority divide themselves vertically as ethnically different. So they don't get into whether they are Sunni or Shia. And then among Arabs, you have the Sunni and Shia divide. And in that particular equation, I don't think, you know, Tariq Aziz figures anywhere. I don't think he's going to be able to make one iota of difference, even if he fully cooperates with America. So what? You know, I mean, he doesn't have any constituency of his own. In the past, his job was to basically a PR man, public relations man, you know, because of his fluency in English. He was very well-traveled, and all the major diplomatic things that happened, he traveled widely because, of course, he's an Arab, he speaks Arabic, and his role was very important at the time of the 1980-88 Iran-Iraq War. I also to remember one simple thing, which is very important to bear in mind. The Islamic Revolution happened in Iran in February 1979. On the 1st of April of that year, they declared Islamic Republic of Iran, and on the first anniversary of that establishment of Islamic Republic of Iran, there was an assassination attempt on Tariq Aziz in Baghdad, and this was done by, you know, a very militant Shia group called Al-Dawa, and that was a starting point of bad blood between Saddam Hussein and the Iranian regime under Ayatollah Khomeini. So I think what I'm trying to point out that, you know, the fact he was Christian was the reason why the militant Shia Al-Dawa activists tried to kill him. And see, and that was the very important event between Iran and Iraq. And from then, of course, relations became very bad. You know, from April 1980, and that was the 1st of April, very important because this was the anniversary of the establishment of Islamic Republic. And it within 6 months, Saddam Hussein attacked Iran, you know. So I think that is something to bear in mind. But his use to Americans is zilch, because I don't think he actually knows, you know, exactly what went on. And even if this is a big, big, big if, there are some weapons of mass destruction somewhere, I don't think he has a clue where they are, what, I don't know, what, and so on and so forth. And therefore, I don't think it will be of any particular use to the Americans.
Well, DeLapiro, I want to thank you very much for joining us, journalist and author of 2 dozen books, including Iraq in the Eye of the Storm, speaking to us from London. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to SARS. Chinese officials sealed off a second major hospital and threw up roadblocks up around Beijing today to deal with SARS. The government announced another 5 deaths and nearly 200 new cases of the deadly virus. China's SARS death toll is now at 115. China yesterday quarantined thousands of Beijing residents who've had contact with suspected carriers of the virus. Isolation orders were imposed on homes, factories, and schools. Residents are being monitored to ensure that they don't flee. Throngs of people are trying to escape at Beijing's railway stations. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization said yesterday Vietnam, one of the first countries to be hit by SARS, had controlled the killer virus, showing that other countries can also contain the virus. Dan Sermon is with us from Vietnam. He's in Hanoi. He's head of Doctors Without Borders SARS mission in Hanoi. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Yes, good evening.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the situation in Vietnam?
The situation right now in Vietnam, I can tell you that in the hospital of Bac Mai, the public hospital of Hanoi, where Doctors Without Borders is working now since a month and a half, there is only 4 patients remaining today. So we can say that the SARS epidemic outbreaks is more or less stabilized now and controlled in Hanoi and in Vietnam.
Can you talk about how Vietnam is containing the virus and the difference between Vietnam and China? You're headed to Hong Kong on Monday.
The fact is, for the case of the Vietnam, it was possible to have a better control on the epidemic, as far as one hospital was the reference hospital for all SARS cases. So all patients and all SARS cases was referring in this hospital. So it was really easy, in fact, when isolation procedure and protection protocols were given to the medical staff to isolate and to protect the medical staff who is working in this hospital. And I think it's maybe the major difference with what's happened by now in Hong Kong or in China. For the Vietnam case, it's that we are only one hospital where all the SARS patients were transferred. So it was easy to control and to manage this epidemic.
We're talking to Dan Sermon, head of Doctors Without Borders in Hanoi. We're going to go to break, and we'll also be joined by Rachel Cohen to talk about SARS, but also how it compares to, for example, malaria on this Africa Malaria Day. Stay with us.
Well, now we're hoping that this war won't spread beyond the current state that it is.
Baghdad Radio says Saddam Hussein braved Allied bombs to visit his troops in Kuwait. The Allies are hitting elite Iraqi troops with all their power.
Here he is with George Bush, who says he loves peace, has led the nation into war.
Why are we in this war?
1991 has begun, and money's 21 now. I don't know, somehow picking up a gun now, loaded with gunpowder, fighting for the system's wrong. The blacks down now, before we used to diss them.
Of this nation, we make up 12%. The front line seems to misrepresent, cause I hear that they're working more than 30% of color there, fighting for some oil, but you think we'll ever get a share?
So don't gas me to go and get gas in the worst way. I'm the first to say pass, G, and don't think that you're taking me by sending me a draft card. Oh, you're making me laugh hard.
So rant and rave, cause I know you say we got to, but I ain't your slave.
Plus my papa told me not.
Time for peace, Paris, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we take on the issue of SARS, the outbreak comes as health advocates are also trying to draw attention to malaria today. It's Africa Malaria Day. Malaria is far more deadly than SARS. The World Health Organization and UNICEF are reporting that some 3,000 African children die every day of malaria. 1 million people die every year. But malaria generally strikes impoverished people in the global south, whereas SARS appears to cross both class and country lines, with Toronto, Canada, under a World Health Organization travel advisory. The WHO is calling for the most effective malaria drugs to be made more widely available. Even insecticide-treated mosquito nets could reduce malaria transmission by up to 60%. In addition to Dan Sermon on the line with us from Hanoi with Doctors Without Borders, we're joined by Rachel Cohen, who is also with Doctors Without Borders. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you talk about the comparison between malaria and SARS and the attention?
Certainly. I think first it's important to say that there is no reason to have to compare or rank or prioritize what is causing human death and suffering. But for us, as a medical humanitarian organization faced constantly with the incredible devastation caused by diseases like malaria and tuberculosis and HIV/AIDS, what's frustrating is to see what can happen when a global public health threat is acknowledged, particularly when that public health threat is viewed as affecting people in wealthy countries like the U.S. and Canada. Massive financial, political, and scientific resources can clearly be marshaled to mount effective responses to a public health threat like SARS, while, as you said, we're witnessing one child dying of malaria every 30 seconds in Africa, 350 deaths every hour from AIDS alone. So for us, it's quite frustrating, even though we're very happy to see massive mobilization of resources for this public health threat, which is SARS. It's quite frustrating not to see similar or proportional efforts to confront massive pandemics such as HIV, malaria, and TB.
If you were in charge of the World Health Organization, how would you deal with SARS and malaria, for example, now? How would you do it differently?
Well, I think simply we need to look at what the actual toll is. Obviously, it's important that there have been 4,000 or so reported cases of SARS and roughly 250 deaths from that disease. And I think it's appropriate that there are massive resources being devoted to mapping the genome, for example, and looking for treatments rapidly. But for diseases that are either predominantly or exclusively affecting poor people, we see no such parallel effort. There's virtually no research and development, for example, happening for diseases like African sleeping sickness or Kala-Azar, which are claiming hundreds of thousands of lives every year. But because they only affect poor people, there's no market incentive, there's no market interest in developing treatments for those diseases, and because they don't affect people in wealthy countries, it's not considered by the public sector, by governments, to be a priority either. So what we simply need to do is have a needs-based, needs-driven assessment of what all of the needs are, both in terms of prevention, treatment, but also R&D, research and development, to develop new treatments for these diseases, and have resources mobilized and allocated according to those needs.
What about the role of the U.S. government, specifically USAID?
USAID has played a very interesting role in terms of malaria. It's actually much like what we saw with the AIDS epidemic several years ago. A couple of years ago, as people may recall, Andrew Natsios, the administrator of USAID, said that Africans were had a different sense of time than those of us in wealthy countries, and that they would not be able to comply with complicated antiretroviral therapy for the treatment of HIV. Of course, this sparked outrage throughout Africa and among those in the AIDS community, but they're saying a similar thing about malaria. At the moment, there are levels of resistance to common antimalarial treatments in Africa, such as chloroquine or Fansidar, which are reaching now 90 to 100% in some regions. It's already reached those levels in Southeast Asia and quickly approaching. These drugs are quickly becoming useless to us in the field and in places in Africa. There are, however, alternatives which are far more effective. They're called artemisinin-based combination therapies, but they're also more expensive. And what USAID is arguing is that it's simply too costly and too complicated at this time to implement more effective treatment. What they say is even if a treatment is less efficacious, if people take it more frequently, the overall effectiveness profile makes it more worthwhile. But we don't feel that's not a responsible public health response when you have a more effective treatment.
Let me go back to Dan Sermon, head of Doctors Without Borders' SARS mission in Hanoi. How does this compare to other diseases in Vietnam? For example, the level of contagion. Dan Sermon, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry. I didn't hear the whole question. I think we were...
How does this compare... SARS in Vietnam, the level of contagion versus other diseases?
The fact is, SARS take now became a huge phenomenon here in East Asia. So it's difficult again to compare, and we cannot compare with other kind of diseases present in the country as well. All the eyes are focused now on the SARS business, and everybody and public opinion and laboratories and scientists and everybody is focused on this SARS business by now. So it's difficult for us to try to have an idea on the rest of other kind of disease that we can find in Vietnam. Doctor Without Borders just arrived here a month and a half ago, invited by WHO, just to work in this hospital for isolation and protection of the medical staff, which was our first priority, because we realized that 50% of the medical staff were the first people who were infected by the virus, because they are in close contact with the patients. And it was our job here to come and to set up a new isolation ward and to train the medical staff on nursing barriers and also on protection protocols to be sure that none of them will be infected. So it's true that even the donors, even the public opinion and all the eyes is focused on this SARS phenomenon. What would be interesting now that the situation is more stabilized for Vietnam is to see what will happen after. This will be really important to see how Vietnam will react now on the rest of the other issues who are really important in public health in this country.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Dan Sermand, head of Doctors Without Borders SARS mission, speaking to us from Hanoi, Vietnam. And Rachel Cohen, also with Doctors Without Borders, the Access to Medicines campaign here in New York. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we move now into our final segment, the undercover officer who ran a drug sting in Tulsa, Texas, 4 years ago, was indicted yesterday on charges of lying under oath during recent hearings to determine if the convictions he obtained were legitimate. In 1998 and 1999, Tom Coleman single-handedly ran an undercover sting operation that ended with the arrests of 10% of the black population of Tulsa, Texas. Coleman never presented any audio or video evidence connecting the residents to a crime. But local courts convicted 38 of the residents. Most of them were poor and African American. 13 remain in jail. Yesterday, a Swisher County grand jury in Texas handed down a three-count indictment that accuses Coleman of making false statements about legal problems he faced in another county while working for the Panhandle Drug Task Force. If convicted, Coleman, who's no longer in law enforcement, faces up to 10 years in prison and a $10,000 fine on each of the three counts. We're joined by Jeff Blackburn, who is a civil rights lawyer, head of the Tulsa Legal Defense Project, on the line from Texas, and Randy Credico with the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice here in our studio. Welcome both to Democracy Now! Let's start with Jeff. Talk about the significance of this indictment, a case we've been following now for a number of years.
Symbolically, it's extraordinary. It's really incredible to see in that courthouse this happen. This is a courthouse that has become synonymous around the country with injustice and with a really evil working of the criminal justice system. So now what we've begun to see is some table turning and some change happen there. So symbolically, it's very powerful. Practically, we have a long, long way to go on many different levels. We still have people in prison that have to get out. We've got a lot of work to do with the Court of Criminal Appeals. This is going to help us, certainly morally, but legally, we have a huge and very difficult fight still ahead of us.
Randy Credico, you've been working on this case for some, 4 or 5 years now?
About 3 years.
Three years. Remind us of what happened and who Tom Coleman was.
Well, Tom Coleman was an itinerant law enforcement undercover agent who was working as a welder, who got a job with the Panhandle Regional Narcotics Task Force assigned to Swisher County, Tulsa in particular. And some days he'd arrest prostitutes in Amarillo. But he, in a year and a half period of time, made about 140 cases against 46 people in Tulsa. And he had no surveillance. He had no corroboration of any kind. Most of the information that he gathered, he wrote down on his leg. And using that kind of evidence, he was able to get about, I think, 8 convictions in trials in Tulsa. He lied in every case. In fact, Sarah Kunstler and I were at one of the trials at the end, and, I mean, the guy was lying. We could not believe that they'd come back with a conviction, and they did, the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar White trial. And he put away In the end, about 20 people in prison, 25, and the other people got probation. Their lives are completely ruined. They're out of work. If they're not in prison, they're out of work. They have no place to go. They can't vote, no public housing, and this is still happening. But he's not the only person at fault here. It's a system in Texas. He's kind of the Lieutenant Cali of the operation, where the Medinas and the Nixons are the ones from the Panhandle Regional Narcotics Task Force who really are responsible for this mess. They did it. They knew he was lying. They knew he was making up cases. But the more cases you make up, the more money you receive from the state and from the federal matching fund programs.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Blackburn, did the state know about Tom Coleman's history? Why did they choose him to begin with?
Without question, they not only knew about his history, but they knew about him lying under oath. From the first trial forward, it became clear to them that this was a guy who was making it up as he went, testifying, as we like to call it down here. Now, the problem that we have is that the real wrongdoers, just as Randy pointed out, that we've identified from the very beginning, I mean, Coleman essentially was just a good employee. It's not for nothing he got plaques and awards for doing what he did, but what he essentially was all about was doing as he was told. And the real wrongdoers in this case, this task force, the whole system of narcotics law enforcement in Texas, has yet to really be brought to justice for what happened here. It's going to be very easy for them now to look at this indictment and say, well, we fixed the system in Texas. We're a long, long way from doing that, and we're a long way, even in the context of this case, from really exposing the truth about what happened and pointing out the true wrongdoers that told Coleman what to do, that directed him in what to do, and that covered for him in the courthouse.
Do you think this indictment would ever have gone down? And, of course, it's an indictment. It's not a conviction. If it hadn't been for the outside attention, particularly the national media, Randy Credico.
Absolutely not. This has been a great example of mobilization through the media. This show here, Democracy Now!, really kicked it off back in 2000. Back in October, it got other big shows involved, got 2020 involved, New York Times got involved afterwards, and definitely it's even Bill O'Reilly is talking about it. So this outside pressure that really started right here and on your sister station here at WBAI is responsible, and I really, you know.
Which goes to the question of, how many other Tullias are there?
They're all over the state.
There's
a place in Caldwell, Texas, in Burleson County, a similar situation that went on. And, I mean, actually, it's all over the state. We get more letters from Texas, the Kuntzer Fund, than we do out of New York, people complaining about similar situations.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much. We'll continue to follow this story. Randy Credico of the William Moses Kuntzler Fund for Racial Justice and Jeff Blackburn, head of the Tullia Legal Defense Project. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That does it for the show. If you want to get a video or audio cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website for more information and web links is www.democracynow.org. And our email address is mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Vilka Tsouras. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Angela Alston and Emily Kunstler. Also, Orlando Richards, Simba Russo, and Johnny Sender. Karen Renucci, Fatima Mojadidi, Rich Kim, Dennis Moynihan, and Jenny Filippazzo. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
We don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer.